Okay. So I will launch into these questions. We've got some very good ones, as often, and some of them are difficult. So start off. This questioner says, oppressors often succeed in silencing the voices of the oppressed. Yet in the Bible, advocacy for the oppressed, the vulnerable, and the disenfranchised is loud and clear. What factors enabled the poor, the lowly, the widows, the fatherless, the immigrants, the prostitutes, and the outcasts such advocacy? Well, that's a good question. Today, in many countries, people are being silenced and not able to speak out the way they would like to. But in the Bible, you have these books that regularly advocate precisely for the people that the authorities would like to have silenced. And so why is that? I think that's the question. How does that happen in the Bible? And so a couple things about that. One is that in the Bible, we don't have very many instances. We have some instances probably, but most instances in which people who are being oppressed or silenced are not the people writing the books. Most of the time, especially in the Hebrew Bible, when you come to the prophets, it is not the people so much being oppressed or writing as advocates for the oppressed who are writing. And so it'd be kind of like a human rights worker in a country that is suffering oppression speaking out on the behalf of those being oppressed. In the New Testament, you could make a case that the Christians were being oppressed and yet they speak out. But it's not really quite like that, because the Christians in the New Testament times were not really much of a concern for the Roman government. And so there really wasn't much of a move to silence anybody in terms of writings in early Christianity. With respect to the Hebrew Bible, most of the advocacy for the poor, the oppressed, come from writers who have a particular theological view. Throughout much of the Hebrew Bible, it's understood that the God of Israel is, in fact, the God of the poor and the oppressed. That makes Israelite religion somewhat distinctive from other religions in their environment. Most religions tend to think that the rich and the powerful are the ones who are being favored by God, and that's why they're rich and powerful. But within Judaism and Israelite religion before that, there had long been this idea that God had chosen the people of Israel, even though they didn't deserve it, even though they were not powerful, they were not strong, they were not wealthy, but he chose them to be his people. And this was proven by the Exodus event, where he saved his people from slavery. And so this was an enslaved population that he chose and then brought out of their slavery and gave them his law, and then brought them into the promised land and allowed them to conquer the promised land. And the idea is that the God of the Hebrew Bible is the God of the oppressed and the poor. This was especially emphasized by the Hebrew prophets, Isaiah, Amos, and others, who advocated for the poor and the oppressed and were upset. And they said God was upset because the wealthy were oppressing the people that God preferred. Jesus himself picked up on that message, and he himself preached a message to the poor and the oppressed. And so I think the deal is that these populations were not seen as a wide threat to their social, political, and cultural environments. They were simply the poor and the oppressed, and the writers could advocate for them. Just as today, there are many people who advocate for the poor and oppressed, even in countries where there are lots of poor and oppressed. Okay. Second question. How likely is it that James, the brother of Jesus, and the first bishop of Jerusalem really existed? And if so, how likely is it that he ever met Paul the Apostle? I suppose it's fine to call James the bishop of Jerusalem. Bishop might be a little bit emphatic for what he was doing. There was no official office in the first century, at least in the first part of the first century, of of the church hierarchy, where you have like the bishop who's the head of the church, and there might be elders under that person, there might be deacons under them, and there's not some kind of hierarchy within the church where the top person is the bishop. But the word bishop in English normally is the translation of the Greek word from the New Testament, episkopos, which we get episcopal from. So the Episcopal Church is called today, is called the Episcopal Church because it's organized hierarchy under local bishops. And so in the New Testament, when the word bishop does occur, for example, in 1 Timothy and Titus, it is translating the word episkopos. And the word episkopos in Greek literally means an overseer. And so it's the one who oversees the church. And so if you're using the term sort of unofficially as the head of the church, then yes, James, the brother of Jesus, was known to be the head of the church of Jerusalem. And the question is, did he really exist? And is it likely he met Paul? Yes, I think it's quite clear that James, the brother of Jesus, did exist. We have good reason for thinking that. One thing is that he's multiply attested in numerous different sources that haven't collaborated with one another. The Apostle Paul is the earliest Christian writer, and he knows James. He tells us that he's met James and conferred with James and had dealings with James. Some of them apparently not all that friendly. So, and he calls him the brother of the Lord, which means the brother of Jesus. And so, yes, he did exist, but not just Paul, but James appears in our Gospel of Mark. In chapter 6, we learn that Jesus had four brothers, and one of the four was named James. His brothers are also mentioned, by the way, in the Gospel of John in chapter 7. But interestingly, we also have attestation to James in a non-Christian source of the first century. The Jewish historian Josephus speaks about James in book 18 of his book, The Antiquities of the Jews, and he calls him the brother of Jesus, who is the Jesus that is called the Messiah. And so Josephus is an independent witness. He certainly hasn't read Paul or the Gospels, but he knows about James, and he actually tells us a story about James, about how James was actually wrongfully executed. He actually says a little bit more about James than he says about Jesus. And so so I think it's pretty clear that there was a James, and I think it's almost certain that Paul met him. Paul himself says so. And it's not that he's trying to curry favor with anybody or trying to, I mean, he says it almost as an afterthought, sort of off the cuff in a couple of places. And the book of Acts narrates that James was the leader of the church in Jerusalem at the time. And so, yes, I absolutely think that that James did exist. I don't think there's really much question about it. And I even skeptical scholars that I know basically, yeah, of course he existed. And did he meet Paul? Yeah, I met Paul. They probably didn't get along that well. And so I think the answer is yes and yes. All right, next question. If you could pick one early Christian writing to add to the New Testament canon, which one would you choose and why? Similarly, if you could remove one book from the New Testament canon, which one would you choose and why? I strangely get asked this question a lot. And maybe it's not strange. Maybe it's the question everybody wants to know. What should be in, what should be out? This is going to be the subject of my next book, about which books got in, which got out, and why. I'll be focusing on the arguments that early Christians had about whether this or that book should be in or not. I myself don't have much of a preference in that the New Testament, of course, is the collection of the Christian scriptures. It's the 27 books that were deemed to be authoritative for Christian belief and practice. And I myself am not a practicing Christian, and so I don't have a horse in that race. But as a historian, I certainly have rather profound and deep interests in the New Testament writings and the early Christian writings from outside the New Testament. And so do I have any favorites that I'd like to be in there? I'm not sure I have any favorites that I'd like to be in there, but it is interesting that there were some books that were not included that would have made a pretty big difference if they weren't included, and that would have been interesting. And as a historian, there's nothing I'm more interested in than things that are interesting. So that would be interesting. I'll just give you two examples. Actually, this first one, yeah, this first example did not almost make it in. But, you know, it would have been interesting if it had made it in. The Infancy Gospel of Thomas that I've talked about a good bit on the blog, that is the book that narrates the life of Jesus as a boy, starting when he was a five-year-old up until the time he was 12, answering this question of if Jesus was the miracle-working Son of God as an adult, what was he like as a kid? And so you get these stories about Jesus, who is the Son of God and has all the powers that would belong to the Son of God, but is a kid, a five-year-old, a mischievous five-year-old, and the kinds of things that he does, doing miracles for his own pleasure, sometimes using his miraculous power to harm people, kids who irritate him, he zaps, teachers who get on his nerves, he blinds or kills with a word. He later raises them all from the dead, so all's good, but it's dealing with this interesting question, what would Jesus be like as a kid? It didn't make it in. I don't think it had much of a chance to make it in, but it would have been interesting if it did. One book that almost did make it in was at the other end of things, after Jesus' resurrection, The Apocalypse of Peter. This is a book that for 300 years was thought by many church leaders to be a canonical scripture. Some church leaders thought that The Apocalypse of Peter should be in the New Testament scriptures rather than the Apocalypse of Paul. I'm sorry. Yeah, well, rather than Paul, yeah. Rather than the Apocalypse of John, rather than the book of Revelation, the Apocalypse of John, that Peter should have been in. Other church leaders thought they both should be in, both the Apocalypse of Peter and the Apocalypse of John. Others thought that neither of them should be in. Well, it turns out in the end that the Apocalypse of John made it in and the Apocalypse of Peter did not make it in. And it's a very interesting question why. I'll be dealing with that probably at some length in my book. I deal with it at length in my book, Journeys to Heaven and Hell, where I try to explain why, even though the Apocalypse of Peter was in favor for 300 years, it fell out of favor in the fourth century. This is a book that narrates a journey to observe heaven and hell by Peter. Peter gives a firsthand account of what the glories of heaven are like and what the miseries and tortures of hell are like. In the original version of this Apocalypse of Peter, when I say original version, what I mean is we have different manuscripts of it, and the oldest and best version that we have of this is what I'm saying, the early version of it. It appears that in this apocalypse, Jesus actually goes down after he dies. He goes down to Hades, and he takes everybody out and provides universal salvation. And I think I'll be arguing that's why this book eventually lost out in the fourth century, because universalism came to be a four-letter word in the church in the fourth century. And so I think that's why they excluded it. Why did they include the Gospel of John, the Apocalypse of John? That's another good question. And so that's the kind of thing I'll be dealing with. But anyway, the Apocalypse of Peter did not make it in, but sure would have been interesting if it did. I think there are others that I'm pretty glad did not make it in that almost did make it in. The Letter to Barnabas. This is one of the apostolic fathers now. It's in the collection, not in the New Testament, but in a collection of proto-Orthodox writers after the New Testament. The Letter of Barnabas is attributed to Paul's companion Barnabas, and it's actually in one of our best fourth century manuscripts of the New Testament, Codex Sinaiticus, one of our very best manuscripts of the New Testament, one of our very earliest manuscripts of the New Testament, includes the Epistle of Barnabas. But I'm glad it didn't get in, because this book, it's a fascinating book. I mean, it's an astounding book in many ways. And so there are things about it I really appreciate. But one thing I don't appreciate is it is thoroughly anti-Jewish. It does not bar any holds in going after Jews for misunderstanding their own religion, for having been misled by an evil angel, that they have scriptures they don't understand, and they God never even gave them the covenant. Well, he gave it to them, but they broke it right away when Moses smashed the Ten Commandments, because they had already broken them, that they never got it back. And God's not on the Jew side. The Old Testament's not a Jewish book. It's a Christian book, according to this Epistle Barnabas. I think that would have been as bad as the history of anti-Judaism was, and it was very bad. And as bad as anti-Semitism that led out of it, anti-Semitism would have been much earlier, I think, if it hadn't been, if this book had been included. Okay, the other part of this question is there any book that I would like to see excluded from the New Testament? I've actually just blogged on this. If you keep up on the blog post, you'll know this, that I blogged on 1 Timothy. 1 Timothy chapter 2, verses 11 through 15 are the primary, it's the primary passage, not the only one, but the primary passage that is used to indicate that Paul wanted women to be silent and not to teach men and have no authority over men. And the author, who is not Paul, I think, the author claims to be Paul, but I think this is one of the non-canonical, one of the non-Pauline books that made it into the New Testament. This book claiming to be written by Paul says women are to be silent and not to have any authority over men, because when they have authority over men, they lead them astray because they themselves are misled by the devil. How does the author know that? Because that's what Genesis says about Adam and Eve. Eve was created to help Adam, and instead she got misled by the devil and misled Adam, and that's how sin came into the world. Thank you very much, women. So women have to be silent in the church, and not just in the church. They can't exercise authority over men. So I wouldn't miss it if that book was my internet connection is unstable, so I hope you're still hearing me. I'm going to go on as if you are. Next question. Do you believe any of the early Christian writers, for example, the Apostolic Fathers, the Anti-Nicene writers, etc., were actually personally taught by students of the apostles? Why or why not? So this is a very good question. The big problem is that we don't know who the students of the apostles were, for the most part, except for by later legends. Let me explain how scholars typically classify the early Christian writers. We have the writers of the New Testament, and by and large, the New Testament writings are our earliest writings. Usually, Paul is thought to be the earliest author writing sometime in the mid-50s of the Common Era. The writings of the New Testament go from there up to probably around the year 120 or so, when likely the Epistle of Peter, book of 2 Peter, was probably written around the year 120. People think maybe other books were that late. But so let's say the writings go between the year 50 and the year 120. That's 70 years. During the later part of that period, there are some Christian authors whose writings we still have. For example, First Clement, not in the New Testament. The Didache, not in the New Testament. Then there are other writings that are proto-Orthodox writings that start appearing after that. They go on till the end of the second century. There's a collection of those writings that I just mentioned called the Apostolic Fathers. So that's a in a modern anthology of writers who are proto-Orthodox. There were some Christian writings, New Testament writings, that were written at the same period in the early second century. in the sagists, such as Justin Martyr and Athenagoras, and usually those are grouped together as apologies, and so on. You start getting heresiologists, writings at the end of the second century, where you have heresy hunters who are attacking heresies. If anybody uses the phrase anti-Nicene writers, what they mean is any writers who were writing books before the Council of Nicaea in the year 325. So the question is, were any of these authors up to the year 325 taught by or were students of the apostles? Well, obviously not the later ones. And I think probably none of our surviving writings was written by somebody who was either an apostle or a student of the apostle. The term, the apostolic fathers, which includes First Clement and the Didache and Barnabas and about 10 or 11 authors, depending on how you number them, some of them, these were originally called apostolic fathers because in the 18th, 19th century, there were scholars who were convinced that writers such as Polycarp and Ignatius and so on were actually companions of the apostles. First Clement, written by a companion of the apostle. Today, that is very much in doubt, and I completely doubt it. I don't think any of these books was written by somebody who was personally acquainted with an apostle. None of them claims to have been personally acquainted with an apostle. The traditions that they were acquainted with apostles come many decades afterwards by people that, in my judgment, probably didn't know them. So in any event, I think the answer is no. I don't think we have writings by anybody who was one of the companions of the apostles. As you may know, church fathers included the Gospel of Mark in the New Testament on the grounds that he was the companion of Peter. Luke and Acts are included because he was allegedly the companion of Paul. Ignatius is said to have known an apostle or known of them or known people did. Polycarp allegedly was an apostle, a friend of ought to have been appointed by Peter to be the Bishop of Rome. These are all legends that I don't think have merit to them. And, you know, I blogged about that some. I may do more blogging in the future. Existence for human beings.
Being in there.
Okay, I'm breaking up.
Yeah, but hanging in there.
Is it badly breaking up?
Keep going. It's okay.
Okay, I'll just we'll keep going and do our best. It's like manuscripts of scripture that have holes in them. You've got to just figure out what's in the holes. All right. So the question is: do any of the New Testament authors implicitly teach? Do they teach or assume any kind of pre-existence of humans? Well, the one place where that may be the case is John chapter 9, verses 1 through 3. This is a passage where Jesus sees a man who was born blind, and he's going to heal this man. In John chapter 9, he heals this man born blind. But when Jesus and the disciples see this man, the disciples ask Jesus, who sinned, this man or his parents, so that he was born blind? That's a weird statement. Did this man sin so that he was born blind? That presupposes that he was sinned before he sinned before he was born. Huh. So, and Jesus tells him, well, yeah, nobody sinned for this to happen. And then he heals the guy. But it sure seems to presuppose that he preexisted. And I don't know if the author wasn't thinking clearly or if he really believed in the preexistence of the soul. But he doesn't say anything else about the preexistence of the soul. And it certainly was not a standard Christian teaching by the first century. I think this is the only passage that pretty clearly seems to indicate it. There were later Christians who argued this, though. Later Christians, including the church father Origen. Origen, in the early third century, maintained that that souls preexisted becoming human, and that becoming human was a punishment for souls that had strayed from God, and he punished them by making them human and giving them a chance now as humans to return to their original heavenly state. This is Origen's view, and he had grounds for it. He argued for it, and he was the one among the early Christians who most vehemently argued that everybody will be saved. In the end, his logic was that God created souls, become humans or other things, they become demons or animals, they become other creatures, but God ultimately is going to have his way because God is all powerful and he gets what he wants. That means that eventually everybody will be saved, but not in this age. The current age is one of many ages that God is devoting to getting people to see the truth. And eventually, after age after age after age, even the most reluctant person is going to realize they were wrong. God is the Almighty who deserves to be worshipped, and everyone will be saved. And that became a universalist idea that was quashed by Christians after Origen's day. That's a related view to the Apocalypse of Peter, which didn't get in because the church fathers started being upset about Origen. But not in the New Testament, I don't think. Okay, next question. In Mark's gospel, Jesus often asks his disciples not to talk about his miraculous interventions and who he is. Some scholars interpret this as the literary device, which could explain why Jesus was relatively little known after his death. Would you agree with this interpretation? It is absolutely right that in Mark's gospel, Jesus often commands people to be silent when he heals them or when they see another miracle of his, when his disciples see him transfigured, when he demons and they confess who he is, he silences them. It's linked to the idea of the messianic secret. In fact, it largely is the messianic secret that Jesus' person and his teachings were kept secret. In chapter 4, we're told that Jesus told parables so that people would not understand what he was talking about. This is Mark chapter 4, verses 10 through 12. He told parables so that they would not understand, not so they would understand. Okay, Mark says that. And so is this in order to explain why Jesus wasn't known very well by the time of Mark? That would be one explanation for it. There are a number of explanations for it. The one that I think is more widely held is that Mark is trying to explain why it is that Jesus is recognized as the Messiah in Mark's own congregation in Mark's time, but it was known that during his lifetime, people were not calling him the Messiah. How do you explain that? That now he's called the Messiah, but like when he was living, you'd think that's when they would know he's the Messiah. Why weren't they calling him the Messiah? And the idea is that Mark's solution is that Jesus hushed it up. So Mark is not recording what really happened in history. He's come up with a literary device to explain the historical situation that he and his church and the church throughout other cities at the time, around the year 70 or so, knew that Jesus was the Messiah, but they weren't calling him that during his lifetime. Why is that? Jesus hushed it up. That messianic secret is removed from the other gospels, especially in Luke, and even more especially in John, where Jesus is known as the Messiah right off the bat during his lifetime in John. Okay, next question. From what I've read, my understanding is that Jews or Hebrews were originally Canaanites who came to focus their religious practice on El, the chief god, such as Baal and Anat. El is frequently used, this person says, as the term for God in the Old Testament as a result. The question is, how did Hebrews end up with two proper names for God, both El and Yahweh? Where did the name Yahweh come from? Okay, very good question. It is widely thought that as opposed to the biblical story where Israel is a people, all direct descendants of Abraham who are enslaved in Egypt, who come out of Egypt and then conquer the promised land, it's more widely thought among scholars today that something else happened, possibly, for example, that these were groups of people living in what came to be called the Promised Land, that they were Canaanites who came to focus their worship on a single God, and that became the God of Israel, whose name was Yahweh. And they tried to spread their views and did spread their views. And later there were legends about how they had actually come out of Egypt and that God had saved them and given them their law and had conquered the Promised Land for them. So that there's actually an internal group within Canaan that grew and worshiped one of the Canaanite gods. So the specific question is, how did Hebrews end up with two proper names for God? So the deal is that in the Old Testament, the most common name, the most common term for God is Elohim. Elohim is a Hebrew plural for the word El. And so it's a plural. I mean, literally means gods. But when the word Elohim is used, it's used with a singular verb. Verbs in Hebrew can be singular or plural, just as you can do in English. You can say, I am and they are. Right? Are is the plural. Am is the singular. Well, you would not say you am. And you're not supposed to say I are. And so the subject and the verb have to correspond in terms of number. Elohim, a plural verb, a plural noun, takes the singular verb. Why is that? Because Elohim is understood not to be plural in number, but to be plural in some other sense, like plural of grandeur or you know, it's like when the queen says, we are not amused, or these days when the king says, we are not amused, doesn't mean that they're plural. It's a plural of majesty or glory or something like that. So Elohim, though, is not, and sometimes the word El is used for God. But Elohim and El and other terms for God are not proper names in the Old Testament. They're not proper names. They're the word God. And there are others that are used as well, sometimes in combination, such as El Shaddai, God Almighty. You get the name Adonai used for God, which is actually not a name. It's a term. It means Lord. You could use Adon or Adonai, my Lord, for your master, if you're a slave, for your boss, for somebody who's superior to you. A wife might use it for her husband, for example. And so, but it's used of God as well. The name Yahweh appears to be a name, a personal name. It's the personal name of God. In Hebrew, it is spelled without vowels because ancient Hebrew did not, in the written Hebrew, did not use vowels. Of course, they use vowels in their speech because you can't talk without using vowel sounds. But in their writing, ancient Hebrew writing does not use vowels. And so Yahweh is made up of four letters. They're four consonants, Y-H-W-H, Y-H-W-H. And we don't know exactly how it's pronounced, but it's usually thought it was pronounced something like Yahweh. But it was the personal name of God. And it, at some point within Jewish history, it came to be thought to be so holy that it's God's actual name. That it was so holy and so different. God is so different from all of us. We can't dishonor him by naming it, by speaking his name. And so it became a word that was not spoken out loud, Yahweh. And so it's got the four letters, Y-H-W-H, in English letters. And so it's called the Tetragrammaton. The Tetragrammaton means the four letters. And so the name of God, the Tetragrammaton, and the Tetragrammaton was not to be pronounced. And so in the Hebrew Bible, when ancient Jews would read and modern Jews would read the Hebrew Bible, and they'd come across the name Yahweh written in the text, they wouldn't say Yahweh. And so especially in the ancient times, they would substitute the word Adonai for it. And so when they saw written Yahweh, they'd say Adonai. Where does the name come from? We don't really know exactly where it came from. The etymology is usually discussed with respect to Exodus chapter 3. This is where Moses, before he goes into Egypt to save the people of Israel from their slavery, He's called by God. He's commissioned by God in Exodus chapter 3. He's shepherding a flock, and he sees in the distance a bush that's burning, and it is not being consumed. There's a flame, but there's no consumption of it. And he thinks that's weird. He goes over to it, and the angel of the Lord is in the bush. And he calls out and says, Moses, take off your sandals. You're on holy ground here. And it turns out this angel of the Lord is actually the Lord himself. This angel tells Moses, go tell the leaders of the people that I'm going to bring them out of Egypt. Go tell Pharaoh, let my people go. And Moses says, well, okay, when I go and say, you know, that you have told me to, you know, have them come out of Egypt, who are you? What is your name? They're going to ask me what your name is. What is your name? And the Lord says, I am that I am. Or I am what I am, or I will be what I will be. It's hard to translate the Hebrew, as it turns out, and there are disagreements about it. But the verb for will be or I am is etymologically related to the name Yahweh. And so it's often thought that the name Yahweh comes from the word I am. But it's not clear if that means that what it means. There are lots of theories over the years, and you may have heard some. That's where the name Yahweh comes from. But it's the only personal name of God in the Old Testament. All right. Here we go again. Another thing with names in other languages. What did Jesus' family and friends call him? When did the name Jesus start being used? Was it a Latinization of Yeshua, and was Yeshua actually his name? I get to ask this question a lot, too, and people always wonder, why do you call Jesus Jesus? That wasn't his name. And, okay, fair enough, but why do you call God God and not Elohim? it's not a name, but why do you call James in the New Testament James instead of Jacobus? That's a name. Why? It's because of the way names work when they get translated. So Jesus and his family would have spoken Aramaic. And Aramaic had a name, Yeshua. Yeshua was an Aramaic equivalent of the Old Testament word Yahshua, which comes into English as Joshua. So in English, the name of Joshua, the one who conquered the promised land, his name in Hebrew is Yahshua. But when it comes into Aramaic, which is a related language, it was Yeshua. So the name Jesus means Joshua. So if you read, okay, so there's that. Okay, so you get to Yeshua. What then? What then is the Bible, the Old Testament, written in Hebrew, gets translated into Greek. And when you have the name Yeshua in Greek, you can't say Yeshua, because in Greek, there's no Y and there's no SH sound. The SH sound is interesting for all sorts of reasons, but there wasn't really an SH sound in ancient Greek. When the Coptic language was invented later, years and years, centuries later, in the early second century, probably, when the Coptic language was invented, they used the Greek alphabet. But they had to invent a new letter for SH, because they didn't have an SH sound in Greek. So to pronounce these words, you had to have an SH, so they invented a letter in Coptic for it, in written Coptic. All right, so there's no Y, no SH sound in Greek, but you're translating this word, Joshua, in the Old Testament, Yeshua, the Hebrew, the Aramaic name. How do you translate? Well, if you take Joshua into Aramaic, it's Yeshua. If you put that into Greek, it's Iesus. It starts with an I, an iota, iota, eta, sigma, omicron, upsilon, sigma. So Iesus is simply transliterating the letters of the Hebrew or the Greek into something like the Hebrew or the Aramaic into something like Greek, so that you can pronounce it. Iesus in Greek is what gets translated as Jesus in English. Jesus is simply the transliteration of Jesus in Greek, which is a transliteration of Yeshua, Aramaic version of, and weird about it. It's not that you're not calling him by his right name. It is his right name, but you're speaking English. You're not speaking Greek, Aramaic, or Hebrew. And this is not like unusual for Jesus. It's like how names work when you're translating from one language to another. Often what happens with a name from one language to another, what happens is not a translation. A translation is this. When you say the word for road in Greek, the word is hados. It can mean road or path or way. But in English, you don't translate it hados. You don't translate it H-O-D-O-S. That you translate it road. That's a translation from a Greek word to an English word, where you take the same letters or the closest things you have to those sounds in the new language. And so Jesus, we don't start names in English with an I-E-S. What do you start them with? You start them with a J. Greek didn't have a J. We do. So that before the E sound is a J in English rather than an I. So it becomes Jesus. Well, that's a long explanation, but I hope it made sense. All right. This one should be shorter, I hope. I have only an intuition, this person says, about this thing, and I've got no evidence to back it up. But in all your readings, have you ever come across anyone who suggested that the bloodthirsty, blood-cursing mob of Matthew chapter 25, verse 27 were pagan? I think they meant Matthew chapter 27, verse 25, were pagan. Okay, so this is referring to the passage in Matthew's gospel where Jesus is put on trial before Pontius Pilate. Pilate cannot find anything wrong against him. He wants to release him, but the Jewish authorities do not want him released. And Pilate calls for a basin of water, and they bring him water. And this is only Matthew. He washes his hands, and he says, I'm innocent of this man's blood. And the entire crowd of people that are gathered together watching this trial cry out, his blood be upon us and our children. This is this so this is this verse that is used for horrendous purposes throughout the centuries as an excuse to persecute and often execute Jews because they were claiming to be guilty for the death of Jesus, and they're passing the guilt onto their descendants. His blood be upon us and our children. So they kill Jesus. Jews are Christ killers. So we're justified in persecuting and killing Jews. Yikes. This person is asking, is it possible that the crowd was made up of pagans rather than Jews? It's a good question, and it's a question that's worth thinking about. And I think normally somebody would ask this question as a way of getting around the problem that it sounds like the Jews at the time are taking responsibility. And the weird thing about this verse, I should point out, is that one of the weird things about this verse, Matthew 27, 25, is that it doesn't say the whole crowd cries out, his blood be upon us and our children. It says all the people, the laos. That usually means something like all the Americans. It means the nation. It means the whole ethnicity group. It's all the people, all the laos. It's not just the crowd there. And so it's one of these kind of things where the author obviously wants you to think of the crowd, but the word actually means like all the Jews. Ah! So is it possible that they were pagans? I think the answer is no. Matthew understands this group to be Jews living in Jerusalem. Jews from around the world would come to Jerusalem to celebrate the Passover feast. And those are the people that the chief priests and the chief priests and the scribes stir up to cry out, his blood be upon us and our children. Well, who's going to be listening to the chief priests and scribes? It's got to be Jews. And so I don't think that's a way around the problem. Okay. This next question is this. Bart, in what way are the Judeo-Christian materials normative for you? What kind of authority do they possess for you and why? Now, I assume that this person by Judeo-Christian materials is referring to probably scriptures. So the Hebrew Bible, the New Testament, possibly Jewish and Christian traditions. Maybe the person's referring to Jewish Christian understandings of the world or Jewish Christian ethics. I mean, one thing to be said, of course, is that, you know, there's not like a definitive Jewish Christian much of anything. There are scriptures, of course, and most Christians do have the same scriptures, and most Jews have the same scripture, etc. So maybe they just mean scriptures, maybe they mean other things. Whatever they mean, I'd say that Jewish and Christian ancient Jewish and Christian materials don't have any authority for me, by which I mean I don't feel obliged to follow them as authorities because they're authorities. I certainly respect the Jewish and Christian scriptures as I respect the scriptures of other religions. I know by far the most about the Jewish and Christian scriptures, and they're the ones that I'm enamored of and the ones that I study for a living and for personal reasons, but I don't feel beholden to them in any way. I don't think that they have any authority over me for knowing how the world came into existence or knowing about what the stars are or for any scientific question or medical question or geographical question or anything like that. I also don't think that their truth claims have any claim on me. I disagree with many of the claims in the Bible. And so the fact they're in the Bible has no bearing on it for me. Many Christians find that upsetting, but the reality is they too don't think the Bible is authoritative for many things for them as well. They may say so, but they don't. Most Christians don't keep Saturday holy. Most Christians don't mind eating pork. They say, well, that's no longer authoritative. Yeah, exactly. That's my point. For me, the whole thing is no longer authoritative. The only thing that really that I think influences me, the thing that influences me the most from the Jewish, the only Jewish and Christian traditions that I resonate with, the ancient traditions that I personally resonate with, are related to ethics. These I resonate with, I subscribe to, and in many cases I try to follow. There are certain ethical principles in the Bible that I completely disagree with. I don't think that, in fact, if a child strikes his father, that he should be executed. I don't think that's true. I don't think it's right. But there are many things that I do resonate with, and that's what my next book is going to be about. Largely, is about the Christian ethics that emerged out of Jewish ethics, and that I think have done the world a lot of good. Next question. This person says, I've just begun reading a book called Creating Christ, How Roman Emperors Invented Christianity. What do you think about their thesis? Their thesis that, in fact, Christianity did not emerge from the life of Jesus, that in fact Roman emperors invented Christianity their thesis is that it has to do with trying to oppose Jews and Judaism, and it was entirely a Roman emperor invention. So what do I think of that thesis? I don't think that it's anywhere close to being right. My view of a book like that is that if you have a penchant for conspiracy theory, I mean, you just kind of generally think that there are things, lots of things going on out there that are, you know, just you're inclined that way, then this is a great book for you. If you're into that kind of thing. But I think if you really want to know about Roman emperors, or if you want to know about Roman religion, and you want to know about Roman history, I'd suggest you read books written by experts, whether they're Jewish, Christian, agnostic, or atheist, who have spent their lives engaged in the serious study of Roman history and religion. And that cannot be said of these authors. You can ask any historian, it doesn't matter what the religion is, about whether it's in the country, and ask them. They did not. I'm just telling you, they did not. All right. Last question I have time for, despite having many others. I'm not able to read this entire question, but I'll be dealing with it in my upcoming course on Did Jesus Exist? A scholar from France, but he's asked it in English. And he's referring to Paul's reference to James, whom I mentioned earlier in this Q&A. James, the brother, the brother of Jesus, as he's called, in Galatians 1:19. This questioner says, Paul explicitly refers to James in Galatians 1:19, calls him the brother of the Lord. And again, he speaks of him in Galatians chapter 2, verse 9, and names him as one of the pillars of the church, along with Peter and Paul. Paul also mentions an appearance of the risen Christ to James in 1 Corinthians 15. And in the book of Acts, James resurfaces briefly as a prominent leader in the Jerusalem church. Acts 12, chapter 15, chapter 21, etc. All right. This person then goes on to point out this James is virtually absent from the canonical gospels. He's mentioned only as one of Jesus' brothers, Mark 6:3, but he's never mentioned as a disciple of Jesus or a leader of the disciples or leader of anyone else. How do you explain this disappearance of James from the dominant narrative, despite his clear historical significance in the first generation of believers? In other words, if James was so important, doesn't he figure in an important way in the Gospels? That's the question. And then, do you agree with the hypothesis that James's marginalization reflects a theological shift in early Christianity from a Jewish Christian movement rooted in Jesus' own family and Jerusalem toward a Gentile-centered theology increasingly shaped by Paul and his legacy? Well, it's a complicated question. It's an important question. It would take a long time to deal with this. There are books that have dealt with this. This author mentioned a particular book where this is dealt with. So this is an interesting idea that's sometimes advanced. The idea is that James is really important early on, but by the time the Gospels get written, he and the rest of Jesus' family have been marginalized, and so they aren't mentioned in the Gospels themselves very much. I think you can read the data that way. I think it's possible to make sense of the New Testament that way. I've never been particularly convinced by that understanding of things. I think that there's a more obvious explanation for why James does not figure in the Gospels and involves the genre of the Gospels, which is that these are accounts of Jesus' life and his ministry with his disciples and the people he's converting. The question is, were Jesus' family members followers of his during his lifetime? Presupposing. But the more common answer is the one that I'm more comfortable with. I'm happy to be persuaded otherwise, but I never have been. The answer I'm more persuaded by is that the followers of Jesus, as precisely as his family, did not think that he was the miracle-working Son of God who is the Messiah. They grew up with him. His brothers probably knew many of his faults. I don't think that they believed that he was the possible Messiah. They knew that he was a brother who was a carpenter for a while, or worked with his hands somehow, who went off and had this religious experience and then began preaching. We have independent evidence of his family not believing in him. Now, you could say that that's the gospel cover-up. The gospels are covering up that his family. They actually did believe him. Plain view, they tried to trash the family. You could say that, but I don't think it really works too well. For one thing, Paul doesn't trash the family. Paul disagrees with James, but he has no qualms at all about him being a leader of the church. we have two passages in the Gospels that are pretty clear that the followers of the disciples, I'm sorry, the family of Jesus did not follow him. In Mark chapter 2, the brothers of Jesus, who are later named in chapter 6, one of whom is James, and his mother think that he's gone out of his mind, and they try to rescue him from the public view. John chapter 7 explicitly says that his brothers did not believe in him. The idea of this alternative solution that I find more comfortable is that during his lifetime, his disciple, his family didn't think that he was the Messiah. And since the Gospels are about his lifetime, not about what happened after his lifetime, they don't give a prominent role to James because he didn't play a prominent role in Jesus' lifetime. There's nothing outside the New Testament, really, of any use that suggests that he did. Josephus of that said mentions James and says that he's the brother of Jesus, but doesn't during Jesus' lifetime. He seems to know that he was a big leader. He doesn't bring him up in the Gospels, in his Gospel. So my guess is that the Gospels don't mention Jesus' brother James, not because they're trying to hide up how important he was, and that or not because they're trying to slouch aside his view of Christianity as having to be thoroughly Jewish. I don't think it's because of that. I think he just didn't play an important role in Jesus' lifetime, and that he did convert. After Jesus' death, there were several people who apparently believed they saw him. And said they saw him and thought he was alive again. Peter seems to be one of them. Mary Magdalene appears to be one of them. Paul seems to be one of them. James seems to be one of them. These people at least apparently said they saw Jesus alive. Well, that certainly converted everyone else. I think it probably converted James to believe that Jesus had been raised from the dead. So I think it's a plausible solution. It's a possible solution, but I don't think that it's a necessary solution. And I really don't see evidence for it. Okay, that's it. I hope you got most of that. I hope most of that got recorded. There were lots of other good questions that I wish I could answer, but alas, I'm out of time. Thank you all for coming. I would like to say that if you have ideas about how to do these Q&As, just let us know. Just write to help on the blog, or write support on the blog, or just send an email to Jen. And any suggestions you have would be great. So, all right. Thank you all. Appreciate it.